House of Comments. I'm Ed Balls, and joining me is George Osborne. Oh. Well, you be pleased you're not listening to those two. You've got the delightful me, Charlotte Henry, and the even more delightful Emma Burnell, who will never forgive me for calling her George Osborne.
Well, no, given that you're the mad right winger and the lefty that people think is a centrist. I mean, Ed Balls is a centrist, far more centrist than I am. But even so, you are definitely the Osborne in this partnership.
Well, I think the main point here is that if any one of us was going to end up on Strictly Come Dancing, it would be you.
I mean, totally.
Yeah, so.
I would. Unfortunately, I'd be the fat one who goes out in the third round.
I think you could put in a good display. I think you'd be good. But anyway, we can't get diverted by Strictly because we have so much to talk about. Emma and I were texting each other this morning, and by 10:30, we had about three different stories to discuss that had happened in the last 90 minutes. Anyway, we've got, because you needed more Partygate reports, there's been a new one from the Privileges Committee and to some of the things that were going on surrounding the report from just a couple of weeks ago. Then things haven't gone very well for the government in court, and its Rwanda policy has been called unlawful. And then we're going to look briefly into the mess that is the Conservative competition to become their mayoral candidate. But I want to take a step back because you'll have noticed that all these stories are really not a good reflection in one way or the other on the Conservative Party. Partygate has been a disaster, and the legacy of Boris Johnson, the failure of the Rwanda policy, whichever way you think about it, is not reflecting well on them. And it made me wonder, is Sir Keir Starmer a rather lucky general? Because in the last few weeks, there has been, I don't want to call it U-turns, because they're not total U-turns and reversal. We're not talking the Lib Dems and tuition fees here. But there have...
It's not the Lib Dems and tuition fees or Theresa May and social care.
Correct. And they're the big sort of hacky U-turns of the recent years that you do think of. But there have been at least three occasions in recent weeks where Labour has wobbled, shifted, whatever kind of softer word you want to use, on some key policy areas. The first one was in early June, where it's changed its plans on the $28 billion a year it was going to borrow and then invest into green jobs. That was meant to happen in the first year of a Labour government. They pushed it back to sort of, the phrase is ramp up from the middle of a Labour government, which is, you know, an important shift. It's not abandoning the policy. Ed Miliband, Rachel Reeves announced the policy on the Today programme. Ed Miliband was deployed at lunchtime to say that the policy wasn't going away. Obviously, it's his kind of policy area, but they were still committed to it. But it's changed. It's a significant shift. And obviously, this is about fiscal credibility, isn't it, Emma?
Yeah, I think it's that difficult point in opposition where you've been kicking ideas around long before a manifesto, long, long, long before a manifesto. And you talk about lots and lots of things and you say things that will get attention that are kind of broad brush things. And then you get much, much closer to a potential election and have to start going, well, actually, what's going to be written down that is our promise to the country that the Lords can't overturn because we've stuck it in a manifesto.
Right. That's actually a very important point, which when considering this, I hadn't thought of, was what the significance of a manifesto on the House of Lords had. That is important.
Yeah. And then also, what is the economic circumstances which we will inherit and how do we
manage those?
With that, both what they are and what the narrative will be. Because the problem is, and I think the problem that Labour is not doing as well with as I would like, is that there is a vast, vast difference between Liz Truss in government with no manifesto announcing a bunch of unfunded tax cuts, which she will borrow to make, and Labour, before they're going into government, saying these are our spending priorities. And this is about investment. It will raise productivity and therefore will raise tax income without raising taxes.
Sure. And that's
what Labour are very bad at, is making that second part of the argument. Okay. And we know that, you know, Labour play politics on the harder setting, as is often said.
Well, you say that. That's your...
No, I mean, it's not just me saying that. It's lots of people say that. We do have a hostile media environment. And so the question is always tax and spend on anything Labour ever said.
It's the same way that the Conservatives always get pushed on, like the NHS, Labour always gets pushed on fiscal credibility.
Yeah. So they are, you know, since Liz Truss, they have stormed ahead on that measure. Rishi Sunak has done little to nothing to overturn that lead, but they are basically just getting as many of their ducks in a row as possible. So I think, and we are, I mean, the difference between 2023 and 1996 is that the economy was turning around by 1996, whereas we just are not at all.
It doesn't feel like it. We obviously don't know what happened in the coming months, and we can only hope things get better. But you're quite right. We don't know quite.
So I think that note of caution is critical. There's also the case that in doing it now, rather than waiting until they release the manifesto, if they expectation manage now, A, they can have the room if things get better to put more things in a manifesto. But also, they're not going to have the stories about Labour U-turns, you know, in April.
In an election campaign. Yeah. I think that's all fair. I just want to pick up a couple of bits and then come back to my earlier point about, you know, getting lucky, as it were. Mm-hmm. So we had this, you know, that was written on Friday, June the 9th. Things exploded again earlier in June around the Conservative Party, and people forgot about this. This was, for a bit, when it was first announced on that Friday morning or whatever, quite a significant challenge. You know, Rachel Reeves, obviously perfectly capable, you know, media performer, but it was a tough moment, and people going, aha, is the Labour, you know, promise starting to wobble? That, you know, that there was a bit of pressure on the Labour Party, certainly within Westminster. We can always say we don't know at this stage how far outside Westminster these things go, and that's probably true, but it sort of mattered. But the moment passed. And then we had, you know, a few days ago, a move to they abandoned a plan for a $3 billion the phrase used in the Times story about it is a $3 billion tax rate. They were going to take $3 billion of revenue and tax from major tech companies, a 10% digital services tax, basically, on revenues who are like, we're talking Google and Meta here, basically. Now, that plan went as well. But in light of concerns that would be a trade war with the Biden administration as the US. Now, Labour's position, I'll read actually the spokesperson quote, which was, our position on the digital services tax referred to the years of 2022 and 2023-2024 and 2023-2024, and was a temporary measure entirely within the rules of the international agreement that we would be doing in that time to cut business rates and help our struggling high streets, because the money was going to be used for business rate relief. So the argument here is, had we been in power the last couple of years, this is what we would be doing. We don't intend to do it when we come into government because the dynamics would have changed. That's the argument. And again, just like the $28 billion green investment stuff we were just talking about, that sort of holds up at first viewing. My issue with, because, you know, that's what the policy was. I just wonder if there starts to become a narrative of these things shifting. And then we had, this is the one you've sort of convinced me is the least of the wobbles, because there has been an abandonment of any talk, basically, within the Labour Party of rent controls, even Lisa Nandy. Correct. With Lisa Nandy, the Shadow Communities Secretary, saying it could actually lead to people being homeless. Although she was the one that first sort of, you called it, you sort of put it out in the world, wasn't she? Lisa Nandy.
It was floated, first of all, by Sadiq Khan and Andy Burnham. And as far
right,
as
two of them, it bigger
might
mess.
Well still be in their manifestos for their cities, right. And they will seek to do it and seek to get the powers from a national Labour government to do it. And this is the interesting tension for me. Labour has not, as far as I'm aware, rode back on any sense of wanting to devolve quite a lot of power. If they do that, the upshot will always, always be that at some point there will be a divergence between what Labour wants to do in Greater Manchester or London or Yorkshire, one of the many Yorkshires, and what Labour wants to say nationally. And we're all going to have to grow up a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. I think it happened a bit where Labour was had some power in Scotland, because that could divert. I mean, that's obviously the SNP have dominated for quite a long time now, but that there's always this tension. You're absolutely, it's perfectly fair to say that there's always a low, you know, a tension within local leaders who are doing things they think are best for the area they are, and what a national party wanting their man to be prime minister has to project. That is fair. My point, and again, I'm going to be very clear. This is Lisa Nandy, spokesperson, said a rent freeze has never been Labour Party policy. So my point about bringing this up at the top of the show before we go into the other things is that there are three occasions now, you know, fairly significant policy areas where Labour has had to at least deny U-turn. You and I could debate to boredom if they're real U-turns or sort of half U-turns or this, that or the other. But there are now three occasions where these stories have surfaced and then disappeared. Now, because something else has exploded, and we're going to come on to what's exploded this morning, well, Thursday morning, when that happens. But it makes me think that, you know, there's even bits have been about House of Lords, hasn't there? That Starmer's, we know Starmer kind of in favour of it, but has sort of said, this is not what I'm going to spend my time on government doing, because we've got to fix the economics. That's always been his argument. So there's now multiple times where you've got Labour sort of walking back on things. Now, you might think the reasons are valid, and then it disappears. I find this really interesting, and it makes me think, actually, is Starmer getting a bit of a, you know, keep the ashes, you know, a nice wicket to bat on as the leader, not by anything particularly either conspiratorial or clever anyone's doing, but stuff is going in his favour. I mean, there was a moment, you must have seen it this week on the Sophie Ridge programme on Sky with Jim McMahon, a Times story about how there's going to be a reshuffle. And Jim McMahon was from the Environment Secretary, was in the story, said that he was going to be one of the people demoted. And Sophie Ridge read the quote out to him live on air as a guest, and he sort of batted it away, said, you know, I'm proud of my record in this position, whatever, whatever. But someone in Labour must have known he was going on and that story would break. There is as well as luck, there is a ruthlessness to Keir Starmer, isn't there, suddenly?
Oh, absolutely. No, so I think both of those things are very true. I also think the corollary is that Rishi Sunak is both very bad at politics and very unlucky.
He has been, I agree with that.
So I think two things are happening. One, Keir Starmer is pretty damn ruthless.
Not something I expected particularly, but maybe I should have.
I always thought he was very ruthless.
Fair enough.
It's one of the things I admire about him, actually. It's like, I don't want to be like that, but I kind of want that person in charge. the Labour plan was always quite clearly spend the first 3 years being absolutely ruthless and sorting out the party, then get into being ruthless about the politics of the wider country, and taking to take a Crosby quote, get the barnacles off the boat.
Lyndon Crosby, yeah. I brought this up, as I say, because I find it fascinating. One, that I wanted to bring up, because I think these Labour policy shifts, let's call them, have sort of disappeared under the radar, and they're worth exploring in and of themselves. And as I say, Sir Keir Starmer is really getting the run of the green at the moment. It's very interesting because as these, you know, the latest of those U-turn stories were breaking. So the rent control one was a couple of days ago when you're listening to this. And suddenly on Thursday morning, as I say, we had, first of all, this report it's from the Privileges Committee. I'll call it another Partygate report. That seems a bit of a crass way to describe it, but you know what I'm talking about, which again, put the Tories right in it. It put, A, having this kind of stuff in the news at all reminds people of Partygate, which makes people angry, which is good for Keir Starmer and Labour. And it wasn't just about Boris Johnson this time. It was not the Boris Johnson show, because it was also cross about sort of allies of his attacking the committee.
Minister.
It was, you know, so named in it were people like Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg, Nadine Dorries, who now, by the way, sorry, we're going to take a little left turn here. Nadine Dorries insisting she's not quitting the parliament until she knows why she's not a peer. You're not a peer because the Prime Minister hasn't approved your peerage.
And you have no right. And imagine being a constituent in Mid-Bedfordshire and just being subject. And from some of the reports that I've read, she doesn't hold surgeries. Her last known address for surgeries is now a dance studio and has been for some time. She's not serving her constituents well and she's not serving her party well. So, yeah, why not have a promotion?
Well, or a job where you don't have to worry about constituents. So some of the people named, said Nadine Dorries, there's Lord Zach Goldsmith.
Well, that's the one that makes this Rishi Sunak's problem.
Because he's a serving minister. Maybe. I'll see how it plays out. This might also disappear. But yeah, it doesn't look great.
Even Rishi Sunak's aforementioned luck, do you think it can go away?
A very fair point. You've got people like Preeti Patel named in there. Is she a baroness? She's got some title now, hasn't she? She might be Dame Preeti.
She's got some sort of a damehood, I think.
Yeah, she might be Dame Preeti to us. There's Michael Fabricant named in there. So Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg. So there's people. It's interesting. Some of the stuff that was a problem was in like GB News, where they're sort of doing extracurricular activities. So all very interesting.
But Nadine's on Talk, not GB.
Yeah, and one was on Talk. Nadine Dorries was on Talk TV. The Jacob Rees-Mogg ones are GB News. That's right. And so
I think that was there when Nadine Dorries interviewed Andrea Jenkins. In fact, I was there. I was sat right next to
her. Yes, Andrea Jenkins is named, but she's actually named largely because of stuff. But anyway, is the report, again, is just reflecting a sort of Trumpian bullying culture. There is nothing wrong with politicians criticizing the activities of other politicians.
And they make that distinction really clear in the report.
So other MPs have the right to raise concerns in the appropriate way and question this committee of their peers. That's fine. But this was intimidatory behavior. We've got those phrases again: witch hunt, kangaroo court, etc., etc. And that, I would say, and clearly the committee feels this, crosses the line.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And I think the committee has taken a hard stance on this to try to make sure that the privileged committee is able to continue to do its job. One of the points they make in the report is that if this is allowed to simply slip by unnoticed, that intimidation wins, maybe not that time, but it wins in the future because people will be less likely to serve on it. They'll be less likely to, they might hold their fire in future.
Yeah, and we should note this. We said this when we discussed the report that was really into Boris Johnson, that gave him would have given him the 90-day suspension and took away his former member's pass. The committee was clearly furious about the behaviour it was subject to, whether it was the Harriet comments about Harriet Harman, about Sir Bernard Jenkin, whatever it was furious. They are determined to hold their line that they are representing the House. They're not just a politician doing, their party. They are trying to protect the integrity of the House. And this builds on what they were angry about with Boris Johnson. It says this special supplementary report puts on record our concern at the improper pressure brought to bear on the committee and its members throughout the inquiry. We're concerned in particular at the involvement of members of both houses in attempting to influence the outcome of the inquiry. Those members did not choose to engage through any proper process, such as the submission of letters or evidence to our inquiry, but by attacking the members of the committee in order to influence their judgment. So if Zach Goldsmith or Nadine Dorries want to write a letter and display evidence that something is wrong about the original inquiry, seems to me the committee is saying we would have welcomed that. You're within your rights to submit that. What you're not allowed to do, or we will not tolerate, is tweet that this is a witch hunt and a kangaroo court, that this is, or say the same things on a television news channel. That is the line, I think, that's really triggered this.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there is a vast difference between saying, I've read the committee's report, I respect the work that they've done, I disagree with their conclusions. And this is a kangaroo court entirely trumped up for political motivations. Those are two
witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt.
Witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt. Yeah.
Exactly. So that was what, 9 o'clock this morning?
Yep.
About, about whatever it was, 10, 15 ish. The Court of Appeal decided that the government's Rwanda policy for asylum seekers was unlawful.
Yeah.
So far, very quiet Thursday morning. Obviously, Suella Braverman has... First of all, actually, I'm going to explain why the what the appeal court's concern was. We should note that two of the judges found it unlawful. One, the Lord Chief Justice did not. He voted... I mean, it's not quite the way to describe it. He was in favour of the government, if you like. But yes, they found it to be unlawful, basically because there are concerns that those sent to Rwanda from Britain, asylum seekers sent to Rwanda from Britain, would then end up in the country they had sought to escape from in the first place. And if you're an asylum seeker, obviously you are seeking asylum from something.
Yeah.
From some kind of person. That is the definition of an asylum seeker. And you and I have said, and I don't care if we say it again, if you want to stop illegal migration and illegal asylum seeking, you have to have proper, safe and legal routes to seek asylum and to seek migration. Fine. Let's get that out of the way. I've saved you saying it. We both think it. So, and they also said, the court said that the Rwanda had, I'm quoting from the BBC here, Rwanda had not provided enough safeguards to prove it is a, and this is a quote obviously from the finding, safe third country. So that's the kind of practical implications. We saw that ridiculous farce where there were poor, obviously quite desperate people sat on a plane not knowing if they were going to be flown to Rwanda or not. And then eventually the law stopped all of those deportations at that time. And this has been going on, rumbling on since. You and I are not legal experts, so let's deal with the politics of it. Do you think this is good for the government because they get to fight the quote-unquote lefty lawyers again and they're, you know, being stopped? Or do you think actually they wanted the win, if you like? That actually there's
a win.
There's a point where they've got to be delivering.
Lawyers is a lot less politically salient than a plane taking off to Rwanda. That's just the basic facts of it. Those people who buy the lefty lawyer argument are voting Tory anyway. The gettable voters who have concerns...
Well, actually, sorry, I'm going to interrupt. Sorry. Do you think they are, or do you think they're looking at the, like, Reform UK things?
Nobody is looking at Reform at the moment.
Fine,
there may be a big change in that, but fine. I mean, Reform are sub 5% at all polling. If they're voting, they're either staying home or they're voting Tory. What they could have got more out of is getting a plane taking off, the visuals of a plane taking off, Suella Braverman doing a big old victory lap, and that creating slightly more, I will vote for them this time rather than
They've got it done.
Yeah.
I think you're probably right. And I think probably, given the way Rishi Sunak does the pledges and like the way he talks, his thing is obviously delivery. He thinks that is the only way to sort of stop
them the blood.
To stop, you know, political oblivion.
Yeah.
That's all. And I think he's probably right about that. This is why, you know, inflation shifting is such a problem. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So I think you're probably right. But so this, again, is just another, you know, Labour in a way, it doesn't matter how many times they change a policy. If stuff like this keeps happening, the Conservatives just, it's by definition of it also being the government, this is always going to dominate, isn't it?
Yeah. And the difference between being in opposition and being in government is that Labour are not in charge of anything currently. So they're working their way up to their policy offer, and if they change their mind on the way up that hill, that's less damaging to them than them not being able to deliver the things they said they would once they get there. So one of the reasons that they are reducing their offer down is because they too understand that delivery is what matters.
I think that's fair. I think probably shifting policies and things like that can annoy activists, that kind of thing. I think it does matter. It's probably okay at this point.
I think it annoys activists on the margins. And I think you might get people being a little, like, the people who hate Keir Starmer in Labour anyway will hate him.
I don't know if it's only that, by the way, but yes.
But hear me out, because that's not where I was going. The people who are kind of, well, Keir's all right. You know, I'm not massively enthused, but, you know, he's all right. They might be 10, 20% more cross now, but they also look at this government and 13 years of Tory misrule and will still get out on the doorsteps. And that's the political calculation.
Yeah, you're probably right. I think probably even a few grumpy activists a year out from an election is less important than a cohesive manifesto.
Like feeling like you're going to succeed.
And also, you know, people care about what's in a manifesto. You know, I might remember what's happened in a year's time because I'm a weirdo that covers this stuff. Most people are not going to remember that in June.
Yeah. They're doing it now. They're doing all these things now because they won't want to do them in 6 months and a year's time.
Yes. Though that's certainly true.
In their national policy forum is, I think, next month. When that happens, they will have a document that comes out of that will largely inform the manifesto.
But it's not the signed, sealed, delivered manifesto.
It's not the signed, sealed manifesto. That's a different process. But it will inform it. They will then want to talk to those priorities at this conference. And what they want to do is get this difficult bit of shifting priorities out of the way before those two things happen. And once those two things happen, then the narrative is pretty much set.
Yeah, okay, that seems fair. And then that will be when the flip-flopping stuff really takes hold.
Yeah, if they flip-flop after that, that's more damaging than if they do it now.
Noted for future shows. Just back to the Rowan thing, because I think your point about both parties now really caring about delivery is right. I do agree with you on that. And this has been such a flagship thing. They've made such a fuss about this. And again, I'm going to speak for you because I know you agree with me on this. This is such a despicable policy. This is such a waste of money.
That's the other thing that happened this week that we haven't even touched on, is that it will cost, 70 grand a year more per asylum seeker to take them to Rwanda than it would to keep them here.
Just treat people the right way. Anyway, it's always been an nonsense policy. It has been a policy I've opposed from the beginning. And, you know, the government is now saying they're also going to appeal this. Like, you know, they can go to the Supreme Court, I believe. Which, again, is setting yourself up to lose again.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean,
I know they've got to keep fighting.
Or they win a very pyrrhic victory, which may not come this side of an election.
Which, again, back to the top of the show, lucky Keir Starmer.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, lucky in his opponents as much as anything else. Because
it doesn't matter. It's like a football team playing another team with loads of injuries or a bit rubbish. Lucky is who you'd get on the day. And he seems to have got to, look, part of it is timing. 13 years of a government, people are always going to get fit up. There's a lot of difficult things that a government is doing and not succeeding in trying to, you know, fixing. And to me, this Rwanda policy seems to be in many ways the sort of absolute clearest example of it, because they make such a fuss about it and the stopping the boats and all of that. The Conservatives really care about this.
The boats tomorrow if they set up clear and legal routes.
You know, I agree with that. So that's that. They're not succeeding in doing it. They keep losing in very public ways. And never mind, you know, people hurt from inflation, and people who care about migration and stopping the boats really care about this. And, you know, it is becoming a sort of mess. And, you know, Suella Braverman can go and do as many photo shoots as she likes in Rwanda. But as you say, unless people have the visual of the plane taking off, the people who care about this aren't going to be happy.
No, and actually, if you look at polling, people care about this a lot less than they used to.
I just wondered this. We've got more to discuss.
Yeah, no, I mean, I happen to have looked at some of this recently. The Fabian Society have a new report on called Lawful and Fair on migration policy.
Honestly, can I just say, I admire deeply your ability to get a Fabian report into almost every show.
I'm not their media consultant part-time for nothing.
Oh,
but the reason I actually know a bit about the polling and trends in polling is because it's in this report. And since 2016, it's become considerably less salient an issue. Now, that's slightly different in different sets of voters. Yes,
and also presumably in different parts of the country.
It's gone down.
And also presumably, like, you care about this a lot more if you live in Kent or something than you do if you live where we live.
Not necessarily, again.
Interesting.
Coastal and rural voters do care about it more, but they too have gone down. There will be very specific pockets around detention sites and proposed detention sites, but that's maybe what 10 constituencies in the whole country.
Sure. I've always found this fascinating because I've always wondered the salience, and it's never been a very salient issue to me, but I've always assumed that is because I'm a London metropolitan elite liberal.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. but more importantly, it's because you work in an industry where you're not being undercut. So if you are, and that ironically was significantly changed by Brexit. Because if you're a builder.
The red alert, Brexit alarm has gone off. I'm stopping you. But
No, this is important because it's actually, I mean, it's almost a pro-Brexit argument. Because if you are a builder who lives in the UK all year round, you have the cost of living in the UK all the year round. If you are a builder who spends the 6 productive months of the year when you can just get loads and loads of work and then go back home to an Eastern European country where the cost of living is significantly lower, you are able to then undercut in terms of cost. And this is why family members of mine voted for Brexit. And there's no answer to that. There wasn't in 2016. That has changed. And the profile of people after the end of free movement coming to the country, despite the fact that, overall net migration has gone up considerably, record levels.
Which we should say is another thing going against the Conservatives who made that a whole pledged.
Exactly.
Well, Keir Starmer could just sit there and let it happen.
The kinds of people who are coming now are different, and they are not competing in the same marketplaces that were causing some of the pressures and tensions that led to Brexit.
Always, it is always worth, when we're talking about these migration and asylum, so it's always worth reflecting on those things. But the bottom line is, this is another big thing. So we've named two that has gone against the government. My guess is the Rwanda thing has much more cut through than another report into Partygate and Boris Johnson at this stage.
In terms of the public, yes.
I think the first one really did.
No.
No, and I think the first Partygate report, the one that came out with the 90-day suspension, all of that, really did cut through.
Yeah, I think what the second Parliamentary Standards Committee report is important. Privileges Committee is saying this is a red line and we are not crossing it and we're not having any further crossing of it. And you either respect Parliament or you don't, and forcing that choice. And that doesn't matter to average Joe voter who's worried about his water bills, and we haven't even talked about talking about
it. I was going to say we could have chucked that in as well.
And but it does matter to how decisions and behaviours go forward in our democracy.
Sure. Oh, it matters greatly. I just think
it matters in that way. In terms of political salience, of course, Rwanda matters much more.
Yes. And so we've seen language from Suella Braverman today saying that Suella Braverman, apparently she told MPs, which she obviously addressed Parliament, that the asylum system was now lining the pockets of people smugglers and turning our seas into graveyards, which I have to say, given the horrific scenes we've seen off the coast of Greece and that, the boat with 700 people on board.
Yeah, horrendous.
I think that is a really grotesque phrase to use. And we'll end this just to begin saying, you don't want people drowning. Find safe and legal routes.
Safe and legal routes. Right. Absolutely.
Quick turn to London and the race to challenge Sadiq Khan. I think he will win very comfortably re-election.
So do I. So do the Tories, clearly, because they've utterly given up on it.
It was a
march of the also-rans before all of this.
So all of this refers to Daniel Korsky, who was a former advisor as well.
David Cameron.
Yeah. And then he has been accused by Daisy Goodwin, the author, broadcaster, that he groped her, that he has sexually assaulted her. And she brought this to the public, you know, quite some years later. I think the incident happened in 2013, but she's brought it now because he was getting further and further in the process to be the nominee, to be the candidate, to be the Conservative Mayor of London candidate. He has immediately and very strongly denied the allegations. He's absolutely clear that this, in his mind, this didn't happen. Just want to make that clear. And he put hate, but he has now withdrawn from that race. He said in a statement, "I've decided with a heavy heart to withdraw from the Conservative mayoral contest. I categorically deny the allegation against me. Nothing was ever formally put to me 10 years ago, nor 7 years ago when the allegation was alluded to." That's the top of it. I'll link to the statement in the show notes, but because it's relatively long, but he's very clearly denying it. It's just, how many more weeks?
Bit Mandy Rice Davis on that one, but we'll leave it at that for legal reasons.
I'm just fed up of having to discuss these stories of alleged wrongdoing in political circles. How many more of these are we going to have to wade through?
Lots.
Yeah. And that's the depressing thing, because you're going to be right.
Whether any
individual case is proven.
There were two other candidates who were quite strong. What was the other one?
There's Paul Scully, the Minister for London.
In particular, who were not shortlisted.
Yes.
And that was largely seen as giving Korsky a clear field. As clear a field as you can democratically do whilst giving the members a choice.
Sure.
And, well, that's worked out for them, hasn't it?
Well, Paul Scully
got this Maz bloke, two of whose advisors were part of the Jingle and Mingle scandal. And Susan Hall, who's nuts.
Our campaign seems to be safe with Susan, is all I've seen. So I have to confess, I haven't followed this campaign that closely just because it seems almost totally irrelevant, because this candidate is not going to get anywhere close to being elected.
I mean, it's interesting. Sean Bailey did better than expected.
Sure, but still lost comprehensively.
Sadiq Khan
ran a poor campaign.
Is not that popular. No. Yunes is unpopular, even though it's the right thing to do. This could be winnable for the right Tory at the right time, but nobody wants it.
No.
Well, nobody who could be that right Tory wants to do it, wants to stand up and say, yes, I'm the face of this Tory party in London right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. It seems, as you say, they're sort of sitting this one out, and Sadiq Khan will win it again quite comfortably. Whew, we've had a lot to get through. Quickly remind everyone where they can keep up with all your stuff.
So I'm on EmmaBurnell_ at Twitter, and I have a newsletter, Hard Thinking on the Soft Left, on Substack.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Twitter. Head over to theaddition.net to see blogs. You can link and join my newsletter there as well and listen to my other podcast, also called The Edition, over there. And I hope you do.
Oh, and also my play that I co-wrote is Monday and Tuesday of next week at the Lion and Unicorn in Kentish Town.
Tell people the dates of that.
So you can just buy a ticket. You have to buy a ticket online. They don't have a box office at the pub. We'll put the link in the show notes.
I saw it and it was a great laugh. So yes, head over to the theatre if you can, if you listen to this before the run ends. Thank you all so much for listening. Goodness knows what we'll talk about when we see you next week.